at one point in my life I was more inspired by people, but as I've grown more, humans aren't really my, I don't really look to that for inspiration that much anymore. I look more inside, just to myself and what goes on in there, internal struggle, internal shit like that. Look inside more than outside. I'm not into really surface reality that much.
We've now replaced all the major machines here for another demonstration. We have...
Before we get into the meat of this conversation, it's a conversation I had with my friend Paul. I'm going to give you a couple sections that I had my friend Chase read from this book called The Suicide Note, or just Suicide Note, by Mitchell Heisman, which isn't really a note. It's actually a 1900-page work of philosophy, of historical interpretation, and it gets into some very strange territory. Mitchell Heisman, after completing this work in 2010, went to the front steps of Harvard University's synagogue and shot himself in the head. Yeah, he was a nihilist, and he followed through with his philosophy. He finished his grand epic, his magnum opus or whatever, and he killed himself like a true nihilist. I'm going to have two sections, very short sections, that I'm going to have my friend Chase read to you. The first section I'm going to have is it's taken from a section of this book that is called The Seditious Genius of the Spiritual Penis of Jesus. It's one of my favorite things to say. It has such a... He was a nihilist, but he had a sense of humor, you know? You're reading, like, hundreds of pages of this guy's thoughts, his... going into his mind, going into this human being's... that is dead. You know that he kills himself, you know, but you read it and you're like, man, I'm really starting to get a handle on this human being's psychology and the way that he thinks about things, which can be kind of complex and gets into some very interesting ideas. But then he'll throw these really hilarious things at a, you know, just kind of comes out of nowhere. You'll be reading about, for instance, in this section, the fall of the Roman Empire due to the spread of Christianity, and he'll throw in something that just like, oh God. And I had my friend Chase read that, this short section of that book. And then I also have a section at the very, very end where, you know, that Mitchell had, this real person, right, had killed himself after completing this. This is the very last section of the book. And it is a short story. It's a Zen parable or a little Zen story. It's very short. It's about a student named Doko who comes to this Zen master and asks him to teach him, and the Zen master throws some very confounding paradoxes his way. And then we'll move on to the conversation with Paul. I don't even know if these two sections that I'm going to put at the very beginning, these two readings, have anything to do with what Paul and I talk about. I just enjoyed having Chase come over and read these sections because I enjoy listening to Chase talk. I like his voice. So I hope you enjoy these very unusual readings, and I hope you enjoy the conversation with Paul, and I hope you all, have a wonderful week. Thank you for listening.
The student Doko came to a Zen master and said, "I am seeking the truth. In what state of mind should I train myself so as to find it?" Said the master, "There is no mind, so you cannot put it in any state. There is no truth, so you cannot train yourself for it. If there is no mind to train and no truth to find, why do you have these monks gather before you every day to study Zen and train themselves for this study?" "But I haven't an inch of room here," said the master. "So how could the monks gather? I have no tongue, so how could I call them together or teach them?" "Oh, how can you lie like this?" asked Doko. "But if I have no tongue to talk to others, how can I lie to you?" asked the master. Then Doko said sadly, "I cannot follow you. I cannot understand you." "I cannot understand myself," said the master. In short, Christianity turned the values of genetic reproduction on its head. Christian memes radically devalue Christian genes. The seditious genius of Christianity, from a purely genetic point of view, is that it radically attacks genetic replication while simultaneously radically maximizing its own mimetic self-replication. The great hereditary aristocracy of Jesus' time was Rome, the Rome that ruled over Israel. To honor Rome was to pay homage to the might of Rome, to kneel before the civilization of Rome, and to respect the gods of Rome. It was Christianity that revalued Rome as the most supreme evil rather than the supreme good. The triumph of Christianity over Rome was equivalent to a pantheon in which the ghost of Jesus ejaculated his spiritual semen in Caesar's face. Rome fell as Romans witnessed Jesus' spiritual semen dangling from Caesar's nose.
Okay, yeah, so we're recording, and I haven't had you... I had you on this thing in a long time. Feels like a few months. And we always have these engaging conversations, so it's exciting to have you back.
Thanks. Sorry, you just... and right out the gate, I do the awkward radio thing of just not saying a word and making faces.
No, it's okay. It's weird, because I have these microphones now, and they're in your face, and I think it makes it more of a professional-sounding podcast, but It intimidates people a little more, especially if they're not used to it. I'm not used to it either, so it's like a thing in your face while you're trying to talk to a person. That could be a bit distracting.
It can be. That you mentioned the intimidation factor is interesting to me, because that you accidentally bumped into something very pertinent to where I want to start with.
So you actually wrote notes, because I didn't have a plan, because I've had a plan for the past few episodes, but I really enjoy getting a friend on that I can have just like a natural I'm not trying to focus it on any particular thing.
Right.
It's just like, we're just going to talk. We're just going to see what kind of weird ideas we can float out there, because that's something we always do for some reason. We have like weird conversations in a good way.
No, yeah. I mean, that's, in my experience, that's the hallmark of, I don't know about other people listening, so maybe it's not the hallmark of a good conversation, quote unquote, but it's the hallmark of conversations that I always feel the best about, like the most engaged and interested in, is that there may be one or two general topics, or it may just freely morph, kind of like a dream does, as the conversation goes on. So, yes, I made notes about a sequence of thoughts that I was having earlier this afternoon.
Okay.
But it's not like I'm going to say, script.
It makes me happy is all.
Awesome. Yeah,
so I'm just... You were just saying it's the... You described it as the theory of, or the evolution of everything. Is that how you said it?
Yeah, if I had to, it is what I said. Yes.
Okay. I'm grilling you right now. Did you not say that?
I know, right?
Did you not say
it? Way to practice gotcha journalism, dude.
I'm on my way. I want to get some good fucking stories. I'm just gonna.
It's awesome.
I'm gonna run with it.
Speaking of which, who knows? Maybe I've just sabotaged my entire intended topic, because I'm going to ask you a question and who knows where the answers are going to take us.
Yeah.
But you mentioned, I don't remember her name, the woman that you did a podcast with a few months ago who runs Ooh La La.
Leah Babayan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Babayan?
She's Armenian, and so she escaped persecution.
Yeah.
You know, she's a refugee. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember the details of her and the section of that podcast that I listened to, that's not relevant. It was that you referenced that in a conversation with me a couple days ago, and in passing said something about her experiencing and or witnessing a lot of like xenophobic hostility in the community, which piqued my interest, because it's... I tend to keep to myself... Mm-hmm. And I've just been kind of focusing on things that I'm doing, and I'm aware of what the world is doing around me in the macro sense.
Right.
contemporary politics and such, but I really, it's surprising to me to hear things like that going on in the same community that I'm around. I'm like, how do I not see that? Right. And I guess maybe I'm just not paying attention.
Well, it is kind of the circles that you, because, I mean, I didn't know about it until very recently, and I think it's just because of the people that I'm now meeting, just more recently. So her story is, you know, she's had this business here in Twin Falls for 10 years, and it's a consignment shop, so she isn't doing anything controversial by any means. It's not like that's the issue. I think it's the fact that she's somehow become the voice of kind of defending refugees and their right to come to this area, because we have a refugee program here.
Yes.
And it's kind of unusual. Not unusual in that there aren't refugee programs, but we're one of the
in this immediate environment, sociopolitically, I guess, is what we'd say.
And, you know, this is a conservative state politically, and I think, considering the climate that we're in now with refugees coming from the Middle East in particular, Leah has been kind of fighting for the dignity of these people in her own way. And she's gotten a lot of hate, not just like social media, which is something that's come up. She's had more like people don't acknowledge her right to exist, you know, that you get when you get into this refugee issue, like, I understand there's a lot of complexity to it, which is what makes it really fascinating, because, you know, what's causing the refugee crisis in the first place. Then also, you know, what do we do about it? And having them here, while I recognize there may be some complications that come from that, you know, there's a general simplification and dehumanization that occurs with people, like, that are from war-torn or impoverished areas that have had to come here. Anyway, so she's been at the forefront of that in this, in some way. She's been at, she's been interviewed by different publications. There was various people from outside the state and outside the city of Twin Falls that have come in to kind of do a lot of the activism, the anti-refugee activism that has emerged here. I've encountered it a few times.
And, like, while mostly listening to you the way that you do when you're having a conversation, like, the half-paying attention to my own thoughts, part of me that was formulating my response already way prematurely, was fully prepared to awkwardly explain that, like, I'm not all that horrified by it because I just, I'm cold to it. I am absolutely not on the side, if I had to define it as choosing sides, of anybody expressing that primitive tribalist xenophobia.
Xenophobia.
Just being a dick in general. But I didn't, I don't feel like stirred up. And I was thinking, like, how do I explain that I just, whenever possible, deliberately try to cultivate an attitude of being passionate and compassionate, but also removed by keeping my eye on the bigger picture of life, the universe, and everything. So I never am very enthusiastic to jump into the fray of human affairs. But as soon as you mentioned there being an actual activism movement regarding the xenophobia and refugees get out of here, like, oh, I guess I was wrong, because instantly, like, this, like, little wave of outraged anger comes over me. I'm like, what? What the fuck? No.
Yeah. It's, well, that's kind of an interesting thing, is that, like you said, you don't, you know, feel or know what's going on in the community, the, you know, the people surrounding us in this city. And a lot of the issues that we pay attention to might be on the macro scale. So, like, what is, you know, for me, for instance, like, what's going on geopolitically, what's going on between the United States and Russia and the United States and North Korea, the United States and Syria, or, you know, it's Russia. And, you know, like, you know, just getting into the conflicts and the complications that have arisen from these various things that are going on around the world. And then when, and, you know, we, of course, we hear about the refugee crisis, like, what's going on in Europe, what's going on in different parts of the world where, you know, people are fleeing their countries, like in Syria or Africa or wherever. But then that's actually manifesting in our community in some way. Right. Like, we're seeing the actual immediate human effect of having people leaving their homeland due to some conflict and due to some program that has been made, you know, that they can bring them and try to integrate them into American or whatever society to the best they can. Of course, again, there's a lot of nuanced or, like, subtle complications that emerge when this type of thing happens, you know, in the communities themselves. And I think
socially, psychologically, yeah, politically,
like, you know, like these people that come here, I mean, there is a difference culturally.
Well, of course, right? Yeah.
You know, obvious things like that. And there can be issues between, you know, customs and how certain things are worked out between these different groups. I mean, but of course, the thing that we must always refuse is to dehumanize these people and to make them feel like they don't belong here. Because
I agree.
This country is, I mean, if there's any country that's ever been built on, you know, immigrants, you know, coming here and eradicating the indigenous population. It is this country.
Right.
And so we have no right as you know, descendants of these barbaric assholes that spread their cancerous genes across this fucking beautiful continent. You know, we cannot.
And unlike so many other parts of the world where maybe the asshole nationalists have a defend my birth territory kind of attitude, like maybe subconsciously we're more like the paranoid lover who has been chronically unfaithful his whole life, being totally paranoid about whether somebody's cheating on him. Because we're the ones who come here and fuck everything up and take it.
Yeah.
And so we know that can be done, so don't do that to us, please.
Yeah, we worked hard to subjugate everybody, so.
I think really that's funny, and maybe there's like a teeny tiny kernel of truth.
Right. It's an exaggeration.
Of course,
obviously.
That's more joking. I hate when, you know, people make a joke and try to put it forward. No, it's a logical point, but yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I say fascinating, but I don't mean it in a that way. I guess what I mean is, like, I am an observer, and I want to talk to people that are experiencing this more intimately than I am, because I don't experience it as a white male, you know, an American white male, you know. I hate labeling myself that way, but there is definitely a difference in experience that I'm going to have based on things that I was just born as, right?
Right. In the context of the conversation,
I
sometimes am uncomfortable acknowledging outright, like, hey, I can be sympathetic hypothetically, but the fact of the matter is I was born hetero, white, male, not, like, heinously ugly, no deformities of any kind.
Right.
And even into a Christian practicing family in the late 20th century America. So, because apparently we call it the America now, not America. I don't see. You mentioned you feeling uncomfortable identifying yourself that way. I don't. I think that's just a wordplay that is hanging you up, I would think, because it's not like your first and foremost idea of who Patrick is from your perspective is, well, he's white and he's male. And
no,
American.
I don't. Of course, I don't think about myself
that way. So it's not
that
you self-identify that way. It's just they are.
I think there are people who are a part of this kind of I hate saying this, but it's like social justice or like a very politically correct way of looking at things, is that I think that there is this sort of there can be a sense of feeling. I feel like sometimes people are a little bit disingenuous because they're not. What am I trying to say here? I feel like the motivations that some of these people have for why that they're promoting their particular political philosophy is not for the reasons they say that they're doing them for.
Are you talking about, I'm not sure I quite followed you, are you talking about both camps in the contemporary American political divide, or are you talking about like the anti-fascist resist movement, or are you talking about white nationalists?
It's interesting, because it's like, I support fighting fascism, obviously,
right,
you know, confronting it whenever it pops its ugly head.
Right.
But there's also this sense that the things that this, like, if you're talking about the anti-fascists, the ones that go out in the street and fight alt-right or neo-Nazis or
Trump
supporters.
Like Punch a Nazi,
right? That Richard Spencer guy, that, you know, white nationalist, they got punched by some Antifa in, you know, whatever protest or rally that was going on. I think it was the Women's March? No, it wasn't the Women's March. What was it? March or something, and they were protesting, and this guy, he's a fucking Nazi. I mean, he did a rally before Trump was elected, promoting Trump. Heil Trump! And dudes are, like, doing the Heil Hitler salute. I mean, there's definitely Nazism and fascism that runs through that movement. You know, that's part of their ideology. And they tend to flock to personalities like Trump and the people that he surrounds himself with. You know?
Yeah.
But what was I talking about? What was the whole point? Oh, yeah.
The hypocrisy and possible disingenuousness of the
West. I might not be able to fully explain my point, but I think what I find is there's a sense of we're kind of looking at it like these are the two sides. You've got these far-right kind of white nationalist racists that are openly racist, rallying for a racist candidate or a racist president. And then you have these anti-fascists who are willing to beat the shit out of you on a college campus.
Because they don't like that what you saying verbally might result in violence it's coming like, at them.
It seems that and I understand like their view, their way that they're trying to approach it is we can't let it happen, so we have to put it down violently. We cannot let these people even speak.
Right.
But feels wrong for some reason. It feels wrong.
Absolutely.
This is the way that this rise of this fear that I think we have justifiably have for this right wing revival, this far right fascist tinged political ideology that's emerging and now is manifest in our presidency. And I think there is a real reason and a real fair concern that people should have for the rise of that. I don't know what the right approach is, because I feel like the old ways of confronting fascism or racism, bigotry, all that, it doesn't really seem to work, because it seems like the things that are actually emerging in our society are not going to go away because you beat up some outspoken skinheads at a college campus or in the streets.
It does exactly the opposite. It just exacerbates the problem.
It seems that that's the case. And the thing is that I'm not even like pro violence or anti-violence. I feel like they're like a lot of these anarchists that are talking about protesting, like, we need a diversity of tactics. So yeah, non-violence works for some people, but for other people we need to actually be proactive and, you know, commit acts of aggression or violence in some way, because it's unfair that the state can wield unlimited amounts of force and violence upon us while we protest in the streets, and we're just standing there like sitting ducks while they shoot rubber bullets and you know, blast sound wave cannons and shoot tear gas at us. I feel like, you know, we have to respond in some way. We have to protect ourselves. So to me, that's where I'm at, is like it's conflicting to see these different groups fighting, because I may identify with one of them politically, but I don't necessarily get behind their actions.
Right.
So it's like, how do we navigate out of this? How do we actually produce a political revolt and a revolt against what's happening in a way that is productive, as well as, I mean, it's understandable to be destructive towards a system that's failing us.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, there's like a small group of people that benefit. We should reject that system, and if that means destroying it and hollowing it out in some way, you know, burning it to the ground, but there has to be some sort of alternative for people to see, so they don't just see it as an act of destruction, but an act of creation.
I couldn't agree stronger with that last sentence that you said. And unfortunately, I have yet to hear any coherently stated, let alone proposed, long-term goal. There's no end game that I'm able to detect. It's all a reactionary, angry, fearful, reaction to, in very many ways, a boogeyman. And I mean a fictitious boogeyman. I mean, I feel more estranged from every corner of American aspects these days than I ever have. And when I say that, for me, I mean, that's a very significant statement, because I've never particularly felt very pro, if we're going to be simplistic and divide America into left or right.
Mm-hmm.
Like each side has horrible aspects, and each side has very defensible positions, in my opinion. So, but now, recently, it seems like the very few people talking about it, and especially the people doing things to make public their views of it, feel like they are being attacked kind of emotionally, much more so than rationally, because yes, it's frightening and discouraging to have this illogical human being who's nothing but a tribal leader who blatantly doesn't even take minimal efforts to conceal that he's just openly manipulative of an ill-educated, emotional public, mm-hmm. that's a dangerous person to have at the helm of whatever organization you belong to.
Yeah.
But to freak out and say, therefore, that is the establishment of an established totalitarian regime going mm-hmm. through its birth throes, is a huge overreaction. And unfortunately, ironically, as often happens in history, the reaction against it looks like the most probable path for it coming to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Because if this comes to a pitched battle or even violence, let me go whole hog. Like, worst case scenario goes outright civil war.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you most likely will have the heavy influence of white nationalist, fundamental Christian terrors
mm-hmm.
helming one side. And on the other, you'll have people who are totally convinced for themselves that they are fighting for liberty and equality and mm-hmm. egalitarian civilization, having completely, apparently, missed the part in history where that's happened a lot, especially in Europe the past mm-hmm. century, and it always has ended up so far with communism and Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a collectivism, and yeah. it's a violently enforced collectivism, and it is, by definition... I don't know, definitions of fascism get murky, but it basically is what we all, I'm pretty sure, mean when we usually incorrectly throw the term fascism around.
Yeah.
We think of it as being like an evil Rush Limbaugh leading this fat white male American army, but it's just as easily the angry college students killing police officers and deciding you and I, because we're white and male and hetero, like, better fucking start walking on some real
fragile eggshells. You find that the values that many white nationalists may have, that their sentiments that they have may carry over to the other side, that there might be that same level of prejudice and resentment towards different groups of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if nothing else, then that prejudice and resentment and unquestionable despise for a group, mm-hmm. so a bigotry against a given group, if nobody else emerges, at least the other side... Sorry, I'm saying that very confusingly. yes, there are aspects of that white nationalist mentality slash philosophy slash political movement that may rub off on the left, kind of prove contagious.
Well, it's kind of interesting, actually, because I read about this a few years ago. They were starting to see, with left-wing activism... like some of the tactics they were using, like Black Bloc, where they have like a group of people dressed all in black. They're mm-hmm. the ones that you see if you ever see pictures or videos of people smashing windows of banks and Starbucks and all that, you know.
Right.
They're all black, wearing things that cover their face.
Right.
And they have tactics for getting people out of police, you know, getting de-arrested from police officers. They have it's kind of cool. It's like, well, I mean, it's cool. Like, that in of itself is a good practice, I think. I mean, less people getting arrested at a rally, the better, you know.
Mm.
Or, you know, throwing back tear gas canisters. You know, they're kind of willing to be they're willing to be more proactive, I guess you could say, in those situations.
Right.
But there's elements of that that has moved over to the right wing, and they were starting to see these, far right groups that were using those tactics for their own means, their own purposes.
Mm.
It's like they're mirroring each other, because I think that they're...
Absolutely.
Because it's like this violence and this fragmentation among our society of Western cultures, it seems like. And I think, maybe not just Western cultures, but... I mean, because I think most cultures now and most societies have adopted some form of, like, neoliberal capitalism. And, you know, it's an interconnecting global economic system. So there's a lot of values that come with that, you know, and how governments treat their people.
Mm.
You know, how money is distributed, how wealth is created, and you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So even in Eastern societies and cultures, they're experiencing similar things
mm-hmm.
that Western societies are experiencing. I just get all these long things and I lose my track.
I do this all the time also.
I can't do this. I shouldn't even be doing this anymore. I'm just going to throw all this into my way. I'm fucking...
So, thanks, fans. Sorry that it didn't last.
And you're like, God, this is the most boring conversation anyway.
we're going to post a
like
normally...
Like, who gives a shit about anti-fascists in their silly little outfits they wear, you know, and they do little Heil salutes to this fucking dead Hitler you dumbasses. It's like, of course it's stupid. And the same thing is, you know, for the other side who think that the revolution is going to start tomorrow. Because I don't know. I really don't think it's going to happen. I think we've been, I mean, unless things really actually start failing for most people, I don't think there's really a chance that, I mean, as long as things keep on clicking along, people are so comfortable, right? I mean, we're talking about these issues like left wing, right wing. Yeah. These are like impassioned, probably dysfunctional people in some way. I don't mean that in, never mind, I actually take that back. Not dysfunctional. They're impassioned, but are maybe they have a false way of expressing their opinions. Or like they don't, like, actually, that's not even either. I think I'm wrong.
Let me try to reframe what you just said, and maybe it was wise to walk it back, but I think you might be a little bit more justified than you're thinking, or not. I don't know. You went back and forth rapidly a couple of seconds there. Possibly dysfunctional people being the most fervently and publicly active on either side of the camp. A really interesting thing happens when discussing human affairs, because the rules that apply to an individual human are not the same rules of psychology that apply to large clusters of humans. So sociology and psychology, like, nod at each other in passing, but they're surprisingly different and really disconcertingly miserable portrait of what this stage of human primates is culturally, because, sorry, I went off on my own tangent in the back of my head there, but
to defend your statement,
I know, right? To defend your statement that the individuals causing the most trouble might be dysfunctional as individuals, possibly, but possibly not either. It just depends. But socially, they're not dysfunctional as in abnormal. Unfortunately, that is the norm. It's just not the norm that we like, and you and I were lucky enough to get born into a time and place where we haven't directly had to worry about this phenomenon in all of human history actually impacting our day-to-day life. And this is starting to get worrisome that, oh shit, maybe we are about to see firsthand just how chaotic human beings can be, because that hatred and tendency to forsake your comfort, which makes a civilization smoothly glide along, becomes very much disrupted. It's a social contagion. The more angry people get coverage and thus are brought to the awareness of the rest of us, we're just kind of doing our own thing, the more we get accustomed to hearing it and seeing it, and we start to form ideas of our own, and pretty soon our ideas become more reactionary to whichever side we like less, and increasingly, one by one, we begin thinking, well, I'm not going to go to a rally, but I'll fucking vandalize that sign, and it just starts inching upward until you have absolute, actual violence. So are they dysfunctional human-wise? No, they're totally normal. Unfortunately, is humanity itself fucking frighteningly dysfunctional?
Well, it's like I kind of sympathize with one side more than the other, but even then I still see how this isn't going to work. You know, that this... I don't know why I'm talking about these small groups of people that are fighting, but I mean it in a broader sense, because I think there is this real perception that we have from the media that we are in different camps. You know, that there's... And there is a sense of, like, difference, obviously, in people's ideas. But, you know, it's, I think that the differences have been magnified, and that
very much so.
And it serves certain interests to do so. So it's kind of disconcerting when it's like it's a positive feedback loop, you know.
Which,
it's going to get worse and worse because more and more people are perceiving both something that is simultaneously true and false, in that things are getting worse and you're not being represented by your leaders, that is openly corrupt, is openly trying to exploit you in the land that you live in, and is going to possibly wage global war to pursue its interests. And when people become aware of that, you know, whatever angle you come at it from, that truth is going to upset people, and they're going to want to act it out. The problem is that we begin to function in a really negative way when it, you know, you're talking about sociology versus psychology. Yeah, we can look at groups and groupthink. So once people begin to attach to particular ideologies that throw things into the mix that aren't true, but just go along with, like, so that initial sense that things are wrong, and then whatever thread pulls you in whatever direction down whatever sort of political philosophy mm-hmm. that you happen to go down,
mm-hmm.
where it could be something incredibly rational and well-balanced, or mm-hmm. it could be something that is incredibly, I mean, it can dehumanize whole groups of people.
Absolutely.
It can create false or unnecessary hierarchies that don't need to exist, and perpetuates, I think, systems that need to be ultimately obliterated if we are to survive as a species.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is that the truth is there, but it's the options that are presented to us as a public. You know, what are your political options? This is what you're supposed to believe in, when in fact the whole thing is rather a very well constructed illusion of how things really work. You know,
I very much agree. You can take or leave. I'd rather like acknowledge that it's on the table, but I don't feel like touching that particular toy right now. The issue of whether or not this media distortion is intentional and being manipulatively employed on purpose by some agency or group of people to some end, maybe, maybe not.
Right.
I don't know. It's irrelevant to me, because unfortunately, even if it is being masterminded by a specific group of people with a specific agenda,
mm-hmm.
whoever they may be, it doesn't change really the big fact that if that's the case, it works because it works on humans reliably.
Yeah.
And that's what's terrifying, is that whether or not we're being manipulated by anybody, it's actually even more frightening to me if we're not being manipulated by anybody, because we're just spontaneously doing the same fucking insane thing we've always done. And to give some perspective of, like...
Well, it's like a snowball going down a hill. It's like the momentum of it is what's carrying us. It's not like someone's directing it, you know?
Yeah, and with humans, emotion trumps logic always. Like, it's not even close.
Yeah.
And you mentioned there being a... Like, if there are two paths regarding preferred and not preferred, by your and my criteria anyway, there's logic and reason and calmly assessing it and trying to work it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's joining the gang and
fuck
them. And the more loud you yell, the more I throw my fist in the air, because those bastards.
Yeah.
And all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you and I... I'll stop speaking for you. I know myself, and I'm pretty comfortable saying, and most other Americans and Western Europeans and any member of a first world nation, got lucky enough to live our entire life from birth to now in a historical situation which is extremely fucking anomalous in
mm-hmm.
history and
mm-hmm.
Human history. I mean, natural history as well, but that's beside the point. Humans are capable of logic and reasoning, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but I think that to get a feel for how the power imbalance between the influence that reason has on human behavior
mm-hmm.
and emotion has on it,
mm-hmm.
I think it's entirely reasonable to speculate that archaeologists have evidence that human beings, as in you and me, genetically full-fledged Homo sapiens sapiens, have been on the planet for at least 100,000, possibly closer to 150,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's speculative, obviously.
In our current anatomical form, basically.
Right.
Right, yeah.
But then immediately, assuming that that's a reasonable estimate, and even if it's not, by the way, the more conservative estimates are closer to like 40,000.
Maybe.
Point is, it's still not even fucking close to the 5,000 years of actual recorded history that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it took us a minimum of 35,000 years from whenever you want to draw the line in the sand that, okay, we stopped being whatever we were before, and now we're Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
It took us 35 fucking thousand years to even start recording our history.
Right, yeah.
Or very possibly 135,000.
Yeah.
And in the last 5,000 years... incrementally, through the still hugely irrational and emotional passing down of superstitious bases of power, such as god kings or naked emotional allegiance to your king just because he's your fucking king.
Yeah.
All of that very gradually has been undermined step by step in a process that's really socially extremely analogous to the mechanisms of Darwinian natural selection. Like, a random mutation happens, either it's advantageous or it's not, and then it spreads to a couple other individuals, and then a few more the next generation, and hundreds of thousands of years go by before significant change is really noticeable. Same thing with our ideas. Logic over passion has been creepily mutating into our social fabric this whole way, and at some point, around the time, I would assume, of the dawn of recorded history, we hit some kind of critical mass wherein we had stable enough civilizations to have recorded history. And I'm not saying, you know, if you want to be all ancient aliens or something on me, that, like, maybe there are huge civilizations that existed 20,000 years ago that we just have lost the records. Right. Fine, maybe. But even then, point is, there was a big, long period where humans were much more like wild animals than what we think of as humans today.
Yeah.
And it took 5,000 years to get from here to the dawn, from there, from the transition from animalism to civilization. And even then, civilization was predominantly based on ignorance, the popularity of rumors, and emotional drives. And, like, 3,000 years after, like 4,000-ish years after the dawn of recorded history, we finally begin to have the inkling of philosophy and science being born again by social mutation, one after the other, and finally gain some kind of foothold. And it's a little bit similar. Ray Kurzweil's idea of the singularity comes to mind. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, well, yeah, because singularity is like a thing that doesn't just mean technology. It means like a new...
When exponential growth hits a slope that's close enough to being straight up that you can't reasonably make predictions about what will happen next because it's happening so fast. So socially... we, before you and I were born, so before the time that I intuitively feel like is my native time era, like my my scale of what it means to be human is a very, very small piece of time, and it happens to be long after, from my perspective, that critical mass was hit. And even luckier for me, we hit like a second critical mass stage where a technological revolution came around, and there was the Industrial Revolution, and now that's growing again. I shouldn't say yet, it's continuing to grow exponentially into a technological ability to manipulate physical reality with increasing sophistication and accuracy. Thanks to logic and reason's slow trudging evolution in the culture of human beings, and it's great that we're here, and because I was born in the middle of it, it seems unthinkable that we could walk back that progress, but it's worth bearing in mind how many, literally how many millennia it has taken for our reasonable traits to override our base animal traits. And that's fucking frightening, because I don't feel as perplexed about why I'm uncomfortable with the shape the left and right thing is taking right now, as you expressed a little while ago. Like, something about the way the left is becoming increasingly militaristic seems like it feels like maybe the wrong path to take. Like, for me, I'm sorry.
No, go on.
It's not just a vague feeling. Like, I can put my finger on it rationally, what I believe to be the case anyway. I don't like that people who perceive themselves as being on Team Good Guy and fighting what they perceive as an encroaching totalitarian state and possibly a racist resurgence, pit themselves against that. And, you know, at an emotional level, I absolutely sympathize with those people. That's the camp. Like, if I had to, I would pick that camp. But I would also be very quick to attend all the leadership meetings and say, no, shut the fuck up. We are doing this exactly the wrong, and we're going to become just like them if we keep villainizing them and getting all worked up and emotional about it. Because the only way around this is to stop what the fuck we're doing and sit down and have a conversation.
Right.
In that vein, by the way, I just accidentally reminded me of why I even asked you about the xenophobia in our small town community. Have you sought or found out Have you had any conversation with an actual alt-right nationalist racist type?
You know what? That's so funny because I know some people who are acquainted with a person. Well, I know of a few people that I could, you know, talk to, but I don't really know because I don't know how they would react to me asking them to be on here. And also, I don't know how I would react hearing them speak. Because it's like a kind of a dilemma because on one end of it, I mean, I'm giving them... It's a small... I'm not like I have a huge platform, but if they were on here, I'd be giving them some voice.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, if I was prepared and was able to contend them...
Yes.
And speak with them and kind of deconstruct or refute with their claims...
Yes.
Which would be my goal, ultimately. I wouldn't just bring them on just to spout a bunch of nonsense and then leave. You know, right, I would like to contend it. So imagine if I could get someone like that on here, you know, what my feeling would be about that is it would be really hard to not get angry and to stay composed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I could do it, but it would be... and it's also actually really confusing because there's a lot of nice racists. I'm white, so they don't treat me too bad.
Right, yeah. We have like a weird backstage pass to the enemy camp by just virtue of being white male. Yeah.
And that sounds... I don't know, that sounds really... What I just said was a little ridiculous. But what I mean by that is... I would feel a little, it's like I get confused when people that are really nice, then we actually get into political conversations and they turn into a different person, right? I've had conversations with people where I work with them and they're really nice, but then you get into a conversation, you just ask them a simple question and they just go off because they've been listening to unadulterated right-wing personality egos for like years of their life, and as soon as anybody asks them, what do you think about this new vice presidential candidate this person got, like toxic waste shit.
You just instantly loaded into their program file. I know. You just instantly loaded up this whole reservoir of things they want to address and have something to say about, and they're angry about it, and goddamn it, that's how it gets expressed.
And I feel like that's kind of their mentality that a lot of these people have. I mean, it would be interesting to hear their point of view and then to try to see how well I could contend them on that. But, I have considered it.
As both a friend and somebody who... So, the friend aspect is, like, I respect and like you at a personal level. Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that we disagree on several significant points, but I think we agree more than we disagree.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of philosophy and psychology and politics.
Yeah.
So as both a personal friend and, you know, when it comes to choosing public position sides of politics, like as an ally, I can't, I mean, obviously there's a thread of respect for the individual's agency that is anarchistic that runs through my philosophy. Mm-hmm. I would never dare tell you what to do. That was so unnecessary for me to say. Like, you're going to walk away from this thing like, that bastard told me what to do. Like, I don't know what neurotic impulse made me say that.
It's okay.
But,
it's just how it goes.
So not to tell you what to do, but for what it's worth, I personally feel like I could not... Fuck that. I think that I cannot encourage you enough to challenge that hesitation that you have about having a guest or two or three on the show to have this conversation, because what you were feeling about the hesitation is natural. It's part of what fuels the mutual animosity and gets built up when we don't do things like release it by talking at the individual level. You mentioned the example of somebody you work with, and not necessarily somebody you weren't specifically.
It doesn't matter who. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So not like in case any of your coworkers hear this, I didn't want to sound like you just called one of them crazy. That phenomenon of knowing somebody at the personal level, then finding out what they think politically or philosophically, and like, oh my God, I hate you.
Yeah.
Like, the same thing happens in reverse. I think it's equally possible. It's just something we don't tend to do because we're not emotionally predisposed to it. To sit down with somebody that I think, you're a dick. Why the fuck would I want to sit down with this person?
Right.
Like, there's nothing that the Grand Wizard of the KKK can possibly have to say that I want to hear. But by doing so, I might walk away thinking, oh, maybe I thought he was a little more evil than he really is.
Well, I mean, we're all a product of various forces in our and environment and all these things. So, I mean, you know, I would recognize at least a person that I don't agree with. There's a reason they are where they are in their life. There's a reason why I believe what I believe as well. I mean, we're all
we're all equal in that way, in that we're all experiencing this life.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't really have as much control over our development as in who we become. I mean, yeah, we do make choices that define us, and we own up to those choices if you want to be an adult, right? Mm-hmm. But there are things that, certain baggages, and there's things that you do, that you just have to deal with in life because of something that you had no control over.
Sorry to interrupt. May I, first of all, take a second to pause and just remember whatever you were about to say before I interrupted you. Sorry. But the reason I was wanting to interrupt is because it's only entertaining to me how much we keep bumping up against topics included in what I was originally wanting to talk about before we started the actual conversation. But to comment on it is lame because that's only happening in my head. Nobody else can appreciate that. So why would I even say that on air? Is to ask you, do you include notes on your podcasts? Because, like, just as a token, I could type up a couple of paragraphs briefly summarizing the train of thought that I thought we were going to go down and how entertainingly it mirrors in so many ways what we ended up talking about, apparently by more or less coincidence.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel like I've guided this conversation intentionally in these directions, but
it just kind of happened anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun.
It is. It's great. Yeah.
I was talking to a guy. I was trying to convince him to be on my podcast because we had a conversation a while ago about manhood and adulthood developing, you know, you growing up and, you know, these certain things that men kind of need to experience in order to become men.
Mm.
Became fascinated with, like, initiation rites and things like that. And we had some sort of conversation relating to that. And then I came and I approached him asking if he wanted to be recorded, just like, you know, like we're doing now. And, you know, I had to sort of explain to him what I get out of it, because, you know, I could tell him, you know, how fun it would be interesting for him to do, but really what I explained to him is, like, it's a selfish thing for me, but when I have people sit down with me and have a conversation, I may have an idea of what I want to address, but ultimately that's going to happen organically.
Yes.
Ultimately there's going to be, like, what I really enjoy about developing this thing, this podcast, this project, is because what I really enjoy about it is I am forcing myself and motivating myself to find interesting people that I can have engaging conversations with.
Yes.
And share that with people.
Right.
And it's like I'm collecting.
That's a cool way to think about it,
but I'm collecting conversations with people and, you know, having people sit down for an hour or so and, and kind of have them have a direct engaging conversation. Having an engaging conversation with them can be very, it's just stimulating. It's something that we don't do as often anymore. I feel like there's a lot of distractions that we tend to have. At least I do. I notice that with my own life. It's hard to have just, you know, undistracted conversation. So,
I really,
it's funny that we're talking about this podcast in that way. Like, it is me. And even getting people that I don't agree with in any way that have views that I find upsetting or, you know, disturbing. It could be interesting. It's like interviewing a serial killer. Like
that,
what I mean? You ever watch interviews with serial killers? They're in prison and they're like, this is what I thought about this, how I feel about this is what I did. And it's really interesting because that person's experience is so different. I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's so different from what the average person experiences. They don't think of things in that way. So obviously they're cruel and they did cruel things to others, but allowing yourself to just listen to another human being that you may despise, but they have a view, and it gives you a more accurate view of what the world is really composed of. Because, you know, you talk about the rise of civilization. That was really the rise of, like, molding humans in our own image, almost. Like, we're going to create cities, we're going to extract resources, we're going to live in one spot, we're going to cultivate ideas, and this idea of being civilized, of course, it goes awry, but there is this sense of, like, creating a human environment for humans only.
Yes.
And like, when you are aware that we are a part of this construction, for me, part of, you know, having kind of a more objective view of it is actually having subjective experiences. Because I realize that there's only one way to really understand the reality we're a part of, and it's to try to understand the people that compose this whole thing that we're a part of.
Yeah.
You know, we don't live as hunter-gatherers anymore. You know, we're not roaming
looking and, you know, foraging for food and living in tribal communities anymore.
Right.
We are a product of the time and place that we're in. So I don't know how to get back to that home that we're all craving to be back to, you know. I'm not sure how to get there, but in the meantime, I'm willing to try to figure out what's going on. If that made any sense.
It did to me.
I had a long day.
I was with you.
Someone gave me a margarita earlier. My girlfriend's mother gave me a margarita for Mother's Day, so that affected. That just made my day took a turn.
Well, for the hour or two when that was pleasant, congratulations, and now when you're paying for it, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
But I it didn't sound like you were rambling to me. I mm-hmm. was with you.
Okay.
And there are like many different directions that I can jump in and say like a version of what I'm kind of chomping at the bit to say. And the more I talk about how I'm being indecisive about how to get into the conversation, the more I forget what my points were. That's really annoying to me.
I love how you talk.
It's because I'm such a wildly undisciplined person.
You sound like a comedian. You sound like Woody Allen in like the 1960s or something when he was doing stand-up comedy or something.
You couldn't have given me somebody cool. I couldn't be like Louis C.K.
Well,
or somebody.
Yeah,
like,
he's cool too.
Fucking Woody Allen.
I don't know.
No, I did.
He's cool.
No, it's funny.
For the creepy part, you know, where he was, you know, rapey and all that. Besides that, he's a genius.
Neurotic comic filmmaker, Woody Allen, cool. Yeah,
it's fucked up. Yeah.
That sense of self and identification and subjective versus objective realities is not where I want to jump in. Because I just
I feel like you're standing on the edge of a pool and our conversation has filled up the pool with various segments and you're like, oh, where do I even fucking jump in on this thing?
Pretty much, yeah.
You're like kind of that kid that's like skittering around the edge, like trying to dive, but they're a little scared because there's just the swimming lessons. Like, just jump in.
Yeah.
Come on, you know how to do it. Yeah, that's what you remind me of. You remind me of a little kid.
That is hilarious. So I am kind of like that little kid. It's not hesitation, like I'm afraid of the water. Why am I running with that metaphor further? Like, you used it well, and I can only begin to abuse it.
You gotta do a cannonball, motherfucker. You gotta do a
jack. The cannonball was, God damn it, you did steal my thunder. There's not as much water in the goddamn pool.
I'm sorry.
No.
I've been drinking.
I'm joking.
Okay.
Sort of. I mean, it's actually true, but I'm not like angry and yelling.
Okay.
That was the joke.
Okay, good.
The idea of the subjective versus objective realities. And how we've drifted. We haven't drifted. We've intentionally moved in the direction of a civilization that has increasingly little to do with the natural world as it existed before we began this process of effectively terraforming the place
mm-hmm.
for ourselves.
Yeah.
Itself, that whole topic, constitutes a huge, really cool, rewarding train of thought for me, which starts with basically this idea that we think of, I mean, nobody, do you exist?
I think so.
Right.
I think
do you have a personality? There's a you,
yeah,
there's, like, there's
right,
a character, there's a,
right.
There's a me too.
I've definitely,
in my head.
Yeah, it changes, you know, depending on what substance I've taken or something, but obviously, or, you know,
obviously,
how my day's going.
Even. Exactly, that's, yes.
Not even.
You don't even have to intentionally manipulate
it's
your
just
chemistry.
How you feel, yeah.
Moment to moment, yeah, yeah. You'll emphasize different traits.
But I do feel like they're yeah, I do exist.
But there's like a core pattern, like think of it like a musical symphony. There's a pattern to the music, but
mm-hmm.
each moment is unique. That's kind of how we think of ourselves, and there's truth in it.
Yeah.
But I think we fundamentally, except for some very rare people who for whatever reason just intuit it by happenstance or talent, like they just see right around that immediately, like, oh, well, that's a lot of game playing.
Mm-hmm.
Or the few of us who just like are fascinated by these questions of a philosophical nature like this, like myself, that just pretty much waste away our lives doing nothing but sitting in the corner thinking about these things, we eventually come across some idea, like we get a glimpse at it. But for the vast majority of human beings who don't either have a natural talent or work, and I'm not saying that my personal opinion or view here is absolutely true at the expense of every other possession, but
mm-hmm.
it is a fascinating way to portray what the experience of being a human person is, regardless of time frame, or culture. One way to conceive of that is that, yes, there is a me, but that me is more parts than not story. Yeah, so this the me that I reflexively, casually refer to throughout the day, I'm doing it right now when I say this, I'm, without either of us really noticing, referencing basically a fictional creature. Mm-hmm. Because the me that has done everything it's done for the 40 years leading up to now and will do... Like, that thing does not exist, but there are still the repercussions of that person's actions in the immediate environment. Mm-hmm. And I assume that a similar pattern will continue into the future, but that person definitely doesn't exist. So I'm just this me right now. Mm-hmm. And if I really, really am rigorous with my self-observation about that, I'm left with no other reasonable way to kind of get my head around that than... I can choose to be me. There's a lot of stuff I can't choose. My biochemistry, my hormone, neurology, the physical size, shape, and molecular and chemical makeup of
you.
Another way that I'm doing it, I was just about to say my body. Mm-hmm. I am a fucking body.
Yeah, that's what you are. You're not.
Right.
Yeah,
there's not the magical me in the corner of my mind that owns a body. I am a body whose complex
history. Have this idea that we're like separate somehow. It's just, it's ingrained. It's kind of ingrained in our thinking, you know, that we're embodying, like we're wearing a glove or something.
So much so that even the people at the forefront of, earlier I was making the case for logic being a much better influence on us, civilizationally, specially, than emotional. So even those of us, I shouldn't say those of us because I'm not, in no way like practicing this publicly and professionally, like Sam Hill or Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, people whose job and vocation and passion it is, kind of ironic that I would use the word passion there, to be intellectual and try to like just figure this stuff out and thereby advance and better everything, but specifically the human experience, even they get caught up to this very day in this debate about whether or not there is a me independent of my body. It's such an intensely strong, I believe, illusion.
Yeah.
And I can make the case physically, biologically, why it's an illusion, and I can make the case hypothetically why it's just as easily interpretable that I am, in fact, that disembodied energy subconsciously creating the physical being. That seems like the much less likely scenario, but that's assuming something as basic as a chain of reaction. I'm way far afield of my basic thought, which was simply that if you really sit down and think about what exactly is going on here, what exactly am I, quote-unquote, you're basically just doing what the Buddha did when he sat down under his tree. And you, in my experience, can't come up with a more reasonable statement than, and it's very close to Descartes' famous "I think, therefore I am." There is this experiential moment right now, and I'm having a handful of identifiable sensations, physical and emotional and mental, all simultaneously. But it's just an experience. It's ephemeral. It's passing. The beginning of this sentence is already in the past. Yeah. That's how fast it is. Constantly refreshing. So it's very reasonable to make the case that if you want to really have the most honest and possibly, I think likely, most accurate relationship to reality, as an extra bonus layer on top of studying the physical sciences and thereby the mechanisms of which it all works, the rules that the other shifting puzzles play by, puzzle pieces is what I meant to say, on top of that, on top of the practice of science, put a rigorous practice of self-observation and constant questioning, and it seems to be the statement itself will become ironic if I develop the... At some point, we'll look back in the statement and think, oh, that's funny. The consensus of people that engage in this seem to uniformly come up with, I don't exist. I mean, yes, I do exist. I'm not saying something as ludicrous as, like, I'm just dreaming and jokes on me. Like, obviously, I have awareness.
Who you think you are is not
is
a
no
word.
Really more. It's only barely more real than a novel character. A character that you read about in a novel and identify with.
I mean, and even like in scientific studies that have been done where they take a situation that like 30 different people experienced that should all just have the same facts available to them, right?
So, not even close.
And they all have different accounts of what happened. So like a bank robbery or, you know, what, I mean, they've had all these experiments that they've done where they've had, you know, some guy come in, do something crazy and unexpected, and people are like, oh, and then they say, hey, what did this person look like? How tall were they? You know, what gender were they? What do you remember about what happened, the series of events that led to one thing to the other?
Yeah.
And everybody has a different thing that they say, especially, and if they hear each other say it, then this
kind of
Yeah, that's why, like, office, you know, people that do investigations, they do it one-on-one, try to ascertain some of the, you know, facts if they can ascertain anything. But it's actually quite remarkable how much of this whole thing we're experiencing is a story that we're making up as we go along.
Yeah.
And that is both a natural function, but also a function of our ideologies and ideas that we have cultivated and we, you know, perpetuated, you know, think about, you know. So it's like it's simultaneously both our biological nature to create story, to have a story of where we came from, what we are. You know, we have this whole, like, even the story of, you know, that science gives us. While there may be theories and facts attributed to that, they're still trying to weave together some narrative for us to kind of understand.
Right.
Like, you know, the Big Bang happened or whatever kind of singularity occurred that, you know, caused the universe to expand. And we, you know, that's a story. They don't, you know, they have hints as to it possibly being true, you know, little traces that are left in the universe, but it may very well be that that's not what happened at all. You know what I mean? But there is a story that science has to tell, and I think that's why it contends so much with religious ideas, because when, and this is the same thing for other issues, where,
because religion is exactly the same thing being expressed and the framework that we need, that we developed prior to really being rational.
Right, right.
And it makes, like, so strong using, because we are only barely rational now. Go ahead.
Right. Using the scientific method to sort of ascertain what's kind of happening, right? And then, you know, people reject the ideas initially. Eventually, those ideas become more common and normalized. You know what the problem is, though? Is that the rate of change for us to move in a maybe bit more beneficial direction, it might be too slow for us to really change.
Are you talking about today's political climate? Did you come back to that? Is that what you're
saying? Like, for instance, like, I know that the climate is changing, right? We're moving in a direction that we've, you know, crossed tipping points in climate, in our, you know, changing climate.
Yes.
And right now, we need, like, massive mobilization to counter the effects of human civilization on our global community, our planet, right? Like, we've changed everything. I mean, within a few years, we won't have ice in the Arctic.
Right.
The ice in the Antarctic is disappearing as well.
Right.
There's cracking. There's giant cracks that are emerging. There's obvious huge signs, and there's predictions that are being made about what we, you know, what could very well happen. And, I mean, it could very well lead to mass extinction. Now, that's on the table.
Yep.
And yet we somehow have a president who has stated that climate change is a hoax, that, you know, the Chinese made it up. And there's all of these policies now to erased climate data that has been, you know, gathered by, like, NASA and various other organizations. I mean, they're literally going full-fledged denialism.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the most anti-science administration that we've had.
Yeah.
Probably ever, I would say.
And don't underestimate W. Bush.
Yeah, definitely. Right. I mean, that side of the political spectrum
always. But that was, like, a couple of lesser, immediately important topics. I mean, and genetic research is hugely significant to advancing our scientific know-how and thus our ability to improve our lives. But it's not the same as, or you can choose to believe this thing, which gives you a chance to maybe we don't all die.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Pretty fucking immediately.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that needs to be addressed very quickly. So the problem is that there's been enough disinformation and misinformation that has been circulating the media, you know, channels, so that people have, it's all muddled. So
it's because our thinking is,
as individuals. They're going after us through, you know, various, they're using manipulative tactics to kind of confound us and make us doubt the data, that information that's being put out there. So
actually, given the, sorry to just blatantly interrupt.
No, go on.
Given the framework of what I just said about the illusory self, just prior to us getting to that point in the conversation, when you speculate an intentionally manipulative media, or at least source feeding a media.
Yeah.
I said earlier I could take or leave the element of conspiracy and intent.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm much more likely to disbelieve that, because where I was going with the illusion of self would bring us right back to would bring us eventually into this topic of civilization and how the collective perception and psychology functions. The deal with the weird sensation of beginning to get your head around you.
Mm-hmm.
And me. I'll just stop even using the second person. Just the idea of getting my head around that I, strictly speaking, don't exist in anything like the depth of character portrayal and dimension and intimacy that I think I do. Mm-hmm. That is fiction. It's memory.
Yeah.
And I can ask a handful of people around me to verify that, but they'll just hand me what I'm asking for.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like an almost, if you don't hear it first right off the bat as like a silly statement of ridiculousness,
right,
then your second reaction might be to think of it as like, all right, maybe an interesting thought toy, but like not relevant to anything. It's dumb. Like,
mm-hmm.
maybe people get frustrated if they believe it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I'm not interested in pushing anybody to believe it. And it is hugely significant in terms of absolutely everything else that a human and all of humans collectively could possibly concern themselves with. Because if it's a jarring, hard, and by hard I mean difficult, concept to get my head around and intuitively understand it all, and then begin to practice and make an attempt to continually subjectively experience that new framework as a reality that I don't exist, I'm ephemeral, mm-hmm. it's just this moment. That's so radically different from the presumptive model cognitively, psychologically, socially that we have in our head that is deeply reinforced every time, literally every time we interact with another human being.
Mm-hmm.
Like, unless you chance across some yeah. Zen master and he happens to say exactly the right thing at that moment and give you a weird insight, which is just about fucking with you, by the way. Like, yeah. they're not mystics, really. They're just, like, pointing out how fucking crazy we all are.
Yeah.
Because we're all so crazy. Like, we walk around thinking this, I'm in this story. Like, nobody else is fucking reading the book that I'm reading. It's only in my head.
Yeah. It's an illusion.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's one that is difficult to get to, or at the very least, very uncommon for a human sentient being to spontaneously arrive at. So much so that, as a group, we don't generally talk about it. As a consequence, we take for granted linguistically easy ways of referring to things, such as me, my history, my mm-hmm. life, my record,
right.
My accomplishments. All of that is nonsense. It's made up. It's just shit. Like, yeah. the world is exactly physically where it is right now, and you can account for how it all got there, but that's it. Anything else is story on top of it.
Yeah.
And that's so far off from the way we just intuitively think continually from many of us, most of us, from the day we're born to the day we die. My thinking, and how I'm tying it back to politics and sociology, is at the individual, single human being level, it's amazing to me how once you see it, and that's just one example. If we have time and it's not confusing, I'll circle back to a more concrete, easy example. But for now, we'll just stick with this illusion of I, of me. It is, the more I sit and get comfortable with it and think it through and not try to convince myself, like I try to even convince myself out of it. Like, you're obviously being dumb. Like, that's not.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I get used to that new framework, the more it seems so weird that fewer other people notice it routinely, and that it's like, it's strange to me that there isn't a movement, and there is. I mean, there are various Eastern religions, for example, mm-hmm. that pretty openly discuss this topic, but it's not common, at least in my culture of origin. And that being the case, it occurred to me that all an absolutely unnecessary limitation, fundamental limitation on our ability, on my ability to perceive reality.
Mm-hmm.
All it takes for one idea, one lack of an idea, to fundamentally blind me to certain facts of existence is for everybody else around me to not bring it up so that it becomes completely invisible by neglect, mm-hmm. and we don't even think to counter it with an alternative way that we might be thinking about or doing things. So civilization itself is just the collective version of that sense an individual has of existing and having a narrative, mm-hmm. and I'm a solid being and I have to look out for my interests and I need to do something to further that story. The group as a whole also does, and that's tribal identity or nation or ethnicity, whatever mm-hmm. tribe you feel like you belong to. It's the same thing. And when you encounter a tribe that identifies with something that's different from what you identify with, it's painfully obvious how fucking crazy that other tribe is. Because why the fuck would I cut somebody's head off for not believing my religion? Why the fuck would I bomb an abortion clinic? Why the fuck would I punch a Nazi in the face?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to harp on right, so the Nazi in the face thing. Like, it goes both ways. Like, why the fuck would I smoke marijuana and have sex with everybody in the 1970s?
Yeah.
No matter what group you're identifying as not your group is, it's plain to see for everybody standing outside the group how fucking insane humans are when they get together and form group ideas.
Yeah.
The current situation we're in with things getting hostile and potentially destabilizing to our entire civilization is most possible and almost, in fact, reliably probable to happen when the camps start ramping up just how much they disagree with each other over these completely made-up ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Total fucking fiction.
Yeah.
We end up going to war and that all hell breaks loose. But the antidote is the very, very slow progress we have been making that has given us, in this day and age, rationalism and reason. And I'm not even saying that it stops completely at rationalism and reason. Mm-hmm. Potentially topic for another conversation, but I don't think rational science is necessarily the end of it all. That's just our best, only tried and true method that seems to have gotten us anywhere, ever,
mm-hmm. yeah.
that we know of.
Yeah.
So this all comes back to the media pitting camp against camp or mm-hmm. the phenomenon of science denial.
Mm-hmm.
But those are all just specific manifestations of that same larger pattern of human beings. We're crazy and we're contagious to each other. Our craziness is very, very contagious.
Definitely.
And right now, by my standards, what I feel like is comfortable and reasonable and I can logically defend to my own satisfaction, those social political givens...
Mm-hmm.
are wildly contrasted by a whole bunch of different groups right now. And for me, it's making me uncomfortable because it's beginning to get to a point where I'm like, this might stop being an intellectually fascinating topic and like a matter of blunt reality mm-hmm. in terms of survival in my future, which again, funny that here I am stating there's no such thing as a past or future self and acknowledging how this thinking impacts
future self. Well, it's like once you start talking about that type of subject, you start to immediately contradict yourself.
It's really, really... Because the language you're using has these assumptions built right into it, as well as my patterns of thinking.
Yeah.
Anyway, so to go all the way back to the should you, shouldn't you have some fascists or other groups that you strongly are predisposed to disagree with. First, you mentioned the emotional discomfort... like you can't imagine that not turning into like a big I'm angry at you when you're back at me fest.
Mm-hmm.
That's not fun. None of us really. Okay, maybe some of us do like to go. That's not your and my thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a deterrent. Another deterrent is feeling like you would fear that this person would come on and have points that you're ill-equipped on the fly to counter, and you might lose that debate. That's another fear.
Right.
A third fear is broadcasting that craziness mm-hmm. for other ears and helping to spread that contagious seed. But the only way that you can counter that contagious seed is going to spread with or without you,
mm-hmm.
and this might speed it along. But you're sending out with it simultaneously its own, hopefully, antidote, which is a demonstration of what we can do about the crazy that we dislike the most about ourselves and we like to change because don't go into it worried that you might not be able to talk the other person out of their opinion
mm-hmm.
because it's been my experience that I mean, my mind isn't significantly changed very often, and I can't imagine a scenario where I'd walk away in a white Ku Klux Klan gown at the end of that conversation. However,
he convinced me. He's right. Right. They definitely are inferior, and I mean, it's obvious at this point.
I can't believe I shamed my white race. No, but that's a huge exaggeration. But my point that comedically I was wrapping around to there was just that if you're going to do that honestly and truly in the service of helping logic and rationality and just good shit of civilization, order, all the stuff that we, at least I think of as being the good natures of humans, helping advance that cause as opposed to sitting down with an opponent and trying to wrestle them into submission.
Yeah.
That's the antagonistic emotional part of you being on
display. I don't want it to go down that way either.
Right. So
no, at all.
Try to keep yourself open to be ready for how surprised you might just be about how many positions, if not you shared in the first place with this hypothetical antagonist, but how once you hear it explained from their perspective, like, oh, suddenly that seems a lot less crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it humanizes them to have a conversation with them, which is why I would like to do that. I would like I'm going to work on doing that, because it's easy to find people that I agree with, but it's another thing to actively seek people that I don't really agree with and have a, hopefully, a productive conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that'll be my goal, actually, for this podcast, to get some contentious...
I would love to hear it. That's awesome.
But we'll see, man, because it could be a bad idea, it could be a good idea. I need to figure out exactly my course of action.
How you feel, what you think, and,
But, yeah, I would love to do that, and thank you for, I think you kind of helped clear up a few things, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, but like I said, I really didn't set out on that topic to convince you or something. But you
made some good points, so I agree with you. We've been talking for a little while.
I know, I've been becoming aware of like, oh, this is getting to be a bit long for
It's a little long, but that's okay. No, this is perfect. This is exactly how I wanted it to go.
Awesome.
So, it's good to see you as always. Glad to see that you're out and about. It's good to be your friend and have you in my life and have you pop up every once in a while. Seems like
of all my friends in the world, you're like one of the two that are geographically closer, three or four, whatever.
Yeah.
You're like one of a very small number that are geographically closest, and I almost interact with you as infrequently as anybody else who's like...
But I just feel like we just pick up where we left off, so it doesn't feel like any time has been lost.
Like
so
rambling is a hallmark of a good conversation. That's a friendship, so...
Absolutely. Cool. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah.